From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As peak tornado season bears down on the southeast, we're looking at who gets aid after disasters. A recent NPR investigation found that federal emergency funding does not often reach people who need it the most. Instead, white people and people whose property is worth more get a disproportionate amount of aid. Robert Benincasa is a producer for NPR Investigations. He researched and reported on the thousands of disaster buyouts FEMA doesn't want you to see. And he's joining me now from NPR in Washington. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, you and your team uncovered inequity in federal funding after disasters. This was in 46 out of 50 states. How first did you discover this?
The bigger picture here is that disasters are getting more common. So there's more opportunities for people to apply for aid. And so we looked at a particular aid program called the buyout program. It's where the government steps in and buys a property like a house so that it never experiences another disaster again, another insurance claim. No one there will ever be in harm's way again. And the government comes in and pays the homeowner or the property owner the market value of that house prior to the disaster. Mm-hmm. And so we asked FEMA for the database of these properties. They refused, and we ended up, NPR sued FEMA and actually got the database of properties after a federal lawsuit.
Okay, so that is the details on the disaster buyouts FEMA didn't want you to see. What did you find there?
Well, we found that most of the buyouts happened in zip codes or neighborhoods, for lack of a better word, where the population was more than 85% white and non-Hispanic. Now, this is out of step with the national population, which is 62% white and non-Hispanic. So this, to us, you know, sort of mirrored the existing inequities in the economy along racial lines. White households are more likely to own a home in the first place. They're more likely to have positive equity in that home, which is important. If you want to take advantage of a buyout, you have to be able to financially survive that process so that when you get the money from the buyout, you can pay off your mortgage on the house and move on. So, well, we saw this as mirroring those inequities across households on racial lines mm-hmm. in the country.
And so you looked at a cluster of these households in Manville, New Jersey. Your colleague Rebecca Hersher looked at another in Houston, where there was devastating flooding by Hurricane Harvey in 2017.
We lost all it in just one day. We lost everything.
And when families lose everything in disasters, they turn to the federal government for financial help. But when the Evans and Papadopoulos families started applying for federal aid, they had radically different experiences. Experiences that are emblematic of a trend: widening inequality after disasters, exacerbated by federal disaster spending.
The white Papadopoulos family, they got $30,000 from FEMA because they owned a home. IRS gave them more than $100,000 in refunded taxes. Janice Perry Evans, the other person that she looked at, black single mother, she got $2,666. Junia Howell at the University of Pittsburgh published multiple studies on how money is dispersed after disasters. Here she is.
We see these same patterns of wealth inequality being exacerbated in communities that receive more FEMA aid. But that's particularly true along racial lines, along lines of education, as well as home ownership versus renting.
So how does FEMA calculate which homes will qualify for buyouts?
Well, FEMA has guidelines that localities like counties and states have to follow. And the local governments or a county government will say, well, we want these homes in this area to be eligible for buyouts. And then the individual property owners will go through the process. But FEMA here in Washington, while they do provide the funding, they provide 75% of the funding for a buyout, they don't decide which homes are going to get a buyout.
That's up to local government?
It's up to local governments, local communities. And, you know, in many cases, it's been up to residents who've gone to their local government and said, we want this or we don't want this.
Mm-hmm. You did speak with David Morstead at FEMA headquarters in Washington, D.C. He oversees the buyout program, and you asked him whether FEMA considers economic or racial inequality for this program.
I'm not aware that there's been a specific study by FEMA or anyone else on the demographic distribution of that approach, but the approach itself is not one that would necessarily intentionally lead to those outcomes.
What do you take away from that?
I take away that FEMA isn't necessarily engaged on the local level and on a community level. They're not in the weeds about the specifics of which community is getting the money and all that. I believe him. I don't think that FEMA is that. My impression was that FEMA is not that engaged on this aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. So who then is not getting the help that they need after a disaster?
Well, you have to look at it this way. When a disaster happens, there are people who are going to be better positioned to take advantage of the help than others. And it might be something that many of us take for granted, like access to a computer, like knowing where your tax returns are, like knowing who to talk to. Those sorts of social inequities can be magnified in this stressful time after a disaster.
My guest is Robert Benincasa from NPR's investigations team, which sued FEMA for documents that showed that white communities benefit more from FEMA buyouts following disasters than people of color, who have often fewer resources. I want to get more into how FEMA funds the program, but state and local and municipal governments are involved. Who makes those kind of decisions?
Well, it's part of the emergency management and disaster plans of a county or a state, and they'll talk to the federal government, and they'll say, we're abiding by the federal guidelines, and we think that this community where there was a disaster like a flood or a wildfire, that these folks should be able to get federal buyouts. And then the federal government will come in, and they'll pay 3/4 of the price, and the locality or the state will pay 25%, and that's basically how it shakes out. It's a joint effort, but FEMA really is more the entity that's writing the check.
Well, you looked at a cluster of buyouts in Lost Valley. This is a neighborhood of Manville, New Jersey. I think it was Hurricane Floyd. And talked to people who were considering buyouts, including Eleanor Neilowaki.
After the first flood, people began thinking, is it time to get out? After the second flood, not again. And the third flood, we've had it.
So did Eleanor move on?
Eleanor did. Her process, like many people, it took a few years for her paperwork to go through and all that. And she and her husband were planning moving to Florida. And unfortunately, her husband died just before they got the buyout. But she did move down to Florida, and she's glad she did. For a lot of people, they're ambivalent. It's their home. She was there for many years. And they're thinking, well, do I want to leave or do I want to stay and try to rebuild my house? What happens when there's the next flood? And that was part of the thinking that she and her neighbors have been going through.
So you got a sense of how communities are affected after people who can afford to leave, have their homes bought out, do. Manville School Superintendent Robert Beers gave you a vision of what it's meant for schools there.
So we had a pretty large demographic shift in town, right, where our frame-reduced lunch rates and poverty rate went up significantly. And we also lost 24% of our ratables.
Ratables means houses that are taxed to pay for the schools. In all, officials say about 150 homes have been bought out. Another 80 are abandoned, and 200 more will likely take buyouts in the future.
We've had to cut programs, class sizes have grown, and quite frankly, we haven't been able to offer the supports that our students so desperately need.
So what happens after a disaster and many of the people who can afford to or who are white, frankly, leave towns behind. What does that look like?
Well, the incomes in Manville, they dropped, and the property values dropped in comparison with other towns around Manville. And the demographics of the town started to change. The Hispanic population became higher in town, and the kids who were many of the kids who were only speaking Spanish in the home, they needed those extra services in the schools, and that's why we spoke with the superintendent of schools. They needed help dealing, you know, about, you know, learning English and that sort of thing. So the demographics of the town shifted, the income and the wealth of the town sort of changed at that point.
So cities are often unequal to begin with, and towns and suburbs in America. Atlanta, for example, is the city with the highest income disparity in the U.S. How does this get exacerbated and shown differently by natural disaster?
Well, you played a clip of Junia Howell, and I think some of her work and some of the things that we found in through our reporting is that, again, the folks who are better positioned to take advantage of the help that's out there go ahead and they take advantage of it, and they find themselves more resilient after the disaster. Their own household wealth and resources might get better after a disaster.
So rich get richer and poor get poorer?
Yes, that's unfortunately, that's so that's one way of putting it. Yes. Someone who couldn't take advantage, they're going to suffer, they're going to take that hit. In a much more substantial way, and they're going to have more problems financially and personally because of the financial and the personal trauma of that disaster.
Well, FEMA, of course, is a big, huge federal agency, and they're making calculations based on worth and value that's in front of them on a piece of paper. A house is worth more than somebody who is renting, right? So which other kind of calculations could even be considered to get aid to people who need it the most?
Well, there are people who are part of this conversation who are saying that policymakers need to start looking harder at social factors, like the things that we're talking about. You know, I'm not going to opine on that. I'm going to leave that to the policymakers. But I think that when we talk more about climate change in the future, we're going to be talking not only about the science of climate change, but about how families and individuals in different circumstances and in different kinds of communities are able to survive and move on and have their changing circumstances, you know, made better potentially after a disaster. So I think that moving forward, that conversation is going to include a lot of those aspects.
Robert Benincasa, thank you so much for your reporting and for your time.
My pleasure, Virginia.
Robert Benincasa from NPR's investigations team, which found that white communities benefit more from FEMA buyouts following disasters than from people of color. You can read more about the results of the investigation and some stories from Robert and his colleague Rebecca Hersher. That's at gpbnews.org. Stay with us. There's more on Second Thought coming up after a short break. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Images are powerful. It was cell phone video and stills of unarmed black men and some women being killed back in 2015 that launched inquiries into use of force by police and sparked the Black Lives Matter movement. That's when visual and performance artist and scholar Fahamu Pekku began to work on what became Do or Die: Affect, Ritual, and Resistance, now on view at the Michael C. Carlos Museum at Emory University until April 28th. We're listening to music from Emmett Still. It's a short film that is part of the multimedia show which counters images of black death and violence with those that affirm life and renewal. Fahamu Pekku is a performance artist, artist scholar, and now Dr.
Yes,
Fahamu Pekku.
Dr. Pekku is in the house.
Well, so this was actually part of your dissertation, wasn't it?
Well, this actually is my dissertation. I, you know, worked with the graduate school and my committee at Emory to be approved to have what's now known as the first visual dissertation.
That's pretty good. So what kinds of questions or thesis was guiding you when you were working on this?
So the large question that drives this body of work is, what kind of life could you live if you weren't afraid to die? Mm. And what was really interesting to me was this idea that the visual culture and visual narratives around Black existence in this country are so intertwined and interwoven with spectacles of death, that death sort of underscores Black life in ways that prevent Black people from living full, thriving lives. And I wanted to create a body of work that would be in conversation with this spectacle, but that would not reaffirm it, that would not endorse it, that would not play into the traumas that the visual narratives have created, but would instead resist the idea that this threat of death and threat of violence that has been so pervasive over Black lives for centuries, that it didn't have any weight. I wanted to take the sting of that threat away.
Yeah, those images, there's been plenty of scholarship and also Media Watch organizations that have looked at overrepresentation of Black death and violence and poverty, for that matter, and criminality in images, especially on local television stations, in print, online. But, you know, something that I was thinking about when I saw this, that those images project danger to one audience, I think, and vulnerability to another audience. What I see in this show, Do or Die, is strength in
resilience.
A very big way.
Yeah. And I think I should also note, too, that when I refer to the spectacle of Black death, I'm not just referring to the physical death or destruction of the body, but also the kind of social death that is also inspired in these images. I wanted to, you know, create something that would affirm our lives, that would give us a healthy way to think about our existence, our presence, our possibility. And again, that question, what kind of life could you live if you weren't afraid to die? Like, you know, that has been a question that has kind of animated my own existence in the world. I spent so much of my young adult life, from about the ages of 18 to 28, anticipating my own demise to the extent that I didn't really even acknowledge or celebrate accomplishments that I had. I was more so kind of ticking off the tragedies that I avoided, you know, because I had been fed this healthy diet of negative ideas and stereotypes and images about my existence as a Black man for so long that ultimately I just assumed that, you know, what's the point in it all?
So why would you even hope? Right. Why would you even think about, you know, future?
Exactly.
That kind of thing. Because Black men are, you know, the idea that a man between 18 and 24 is about as likely to die as, I don't remember the statistics.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics are daunting. You know, I recently did a TED Talk, and I shared as a part of that TED Talk this experience I had when I was 18 and I saw the film Menace to Society. And literally, after walking out of the theater that day, I just was waiting on, you know, a drive-by or some crazy thing to happen to me. And mind you, I was about as far removed from that kind of lifestyle as anyone could be. But just, you know, being a Black man and seeing those kinds of images, hearing those kinds of stories over and over again, I just assumed that that was going to happen to me.
But for you, part of your healing, part of your moving into another place was making art,
exactly.
I think, but also spirituality. And there is a lot of spirituality in this show, certainly. And there are a lot of images that are influenced by the Ifa.
This is
a spiritual practice drawn from Yoruba traditions. Mm-hmm. And these are beliefs and a real whole cosmology carried by enslaved people from Africa, Nigeria primarily, I think, right?
Well, and pretty much Central and West Africa. It has many different names even amongst those populations, but the Yoruba is probably one of the most urbane civilizations at that time, and those practices really spread far and wide.
Right, and they came to the U.S., carried to the U.S., Brazil, Cuba, the Caribbean.
When you mentioned before how art was a kind of way for me to work through some of this trauma, and thinking about the fact that my art was really sort of rooted in this kind of spiritual ideology that I didn't quite have a language for until I was introduced to Ifa around 2002. Mm-hmm. I ran into a friend of mine who I hadn't seen in a few years, actually. And when I saw him, he had just returned from becoming initiated as a Babalawo, or a priest, in the Ifa tradition. Mm-hmm. And it piqued my interest. I ended up going to an Ile that was here, a temple that was here in Atlanta. And it was the first time that I ever walked into a religious or spiritual institution or space and felt instantly at home. And
did you grow up in the church, like a traditional Baptist church?
I was the dude inside. When you unlock the church door on Sunday, I was already inside. I was, growing up, I grew up in the projects in South Carolina, and we were super poor, so we didn't really have a lot of things that we could do. We could go to school and we can go to church. Mm. And so that was where I kind of thrived in those spaces, because it was like the only outlet that I had.
Mm-hmm. So you said you felt at home in this place when you were in church as a kid. You said maybe it was one of the only things to do, but did you feel like you were just sort of performing piety or something, or was just part of the culture?
No, it wasn't necessarily performing piety, but it was certainly a space that created for me more questions than answers. And oftentimes those, like the questions that I would ask would be shut down. You know, I can remember being like 6 or 7 years old in a Sunday school class and asking my Sunday school teacher, for clarification about something that she had explained, like, well, why didn't they just do, don't ask questions, you just have to believe, that kind of thing. And, once I left South Carolina and I came here to Atlanta, I experimented with a lot of different spiritual systems, from Islam to Buddhism, you name it. I was trying to find my way. I've always felt a really deep spiritual sensibility about myself, but Ifa gave me language. Like, it gave me a way to not only talk about what I was doing, but to also think through the ideas and concepts that were in my head. Like, it really grounded me.
Well, so this comes together in the Yoruba tradition. There's a great distinction between the body and the spirit,
yes,
right? There's this separation. And your work has been focused on images of the body, mm-hmm, a lot of them playing with black masculinity, or making the viewer question what they see or how we register images of,
right,
black masculinity. Spirit is nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
So how have you, as you said, this has been a through line in your work, created or communicated that spirit?
I've been exploring this concept that's very popular amongst African philosophers called remembering, remembering,
mm-hmm,
which is essentially this concept rooted in the idea that black subjectivity has been fragmented and broken up and destroyed and dismembered, disfigured. And that the one true way to really begin to understand one's subjectivity is to begin to remember these pieces, to put yourself back together, to understand your cultural memory, language, history, spirituality, all these different kinds of things, and reassess, the black body.
Right. So the members have sort of scattered, but it's,
right,
about bringing them back
bringing
together.
Bringing it back together, yeah.
Fahamu Peku is my guest. He is a performance artist. He's an artist. He's a doctor, I should have noted before that. But also, we're talking about his show, Do or Die, which is now at Emory. Now, it began at the Halsey Institute of Art in Charleston, South Carolina. And let's bring in part of that sort of performative aspect. So this is you in, let's say, a full body mask,
mm-hmm,
and the piece is called New World Egungun. What is this?
So the Egungun in the Yoruba tradition are the ancestors. The Egungun is the power concealed. And so a Egungun mask gives shape and form to these unseen spirits, to these ancestral spirits. And Egungun are very significant in the tradition and throughout the diaspora now. You have Egungun who come out to celebrate with the community. You have Egungun that come out to adjudicate issues that might arise within a community. You have Egungun that come out to honor you know, the ancestors, and just to, you know, really be a bridge between the spiritual and the physical worlds. My new world at Gungun is an Egungun that I created specifically to honor the lives of black men and boys who have been killed by various racist forms of violence. Mm-hmm. And so the Egungun honors men who've been killed by police officers, men who've been assassinated during the civil rights era, men who were lynched during the Jim Crow era, and just largely just the sort of disruption of violence to black bodies in this new world context.
Mm-hmm. And so you have strips of cloth that mm-hmm. are, you know, sort of like, it almost, there's a film of it. It's quite, it's beautiful, you know, it almost looks like a jellyfish because there's yes. like this round shaped, I don't know, structure, mm-hmm. and then all these strips of cloth, but on the strips of cloth it says Medgar, Martin, yes. you know, the names exactly. of the martyrs. So we, quite literally you are carrying the, yes. The spirits of yes. the dead here.
And not only carrying them, but giving them a way to re-engage so that they move from victims to honored ancestors. And so that really became a part of, and really central to the exhibition. The Egungun is really the heartbeat, the heart and soul of Do or Die, of the exhibition.
The Egungun stops and in front of the Emmanuel yes. African Methodist Episcopal Church, mm-hmm. the Emmanuel AME Church, site of course, the 2015 yes. massacre, racially motivated, mm-hmm. clearly racially motivated massacre. In fact, the one, I'm not going to say his name, was going to start, or hoping to start, a race war.
Yes, yeah.
Right. So what did it mean to stop in front of that place with this crowd?
To give the full picture, the Egungun actually emerges from the waterfront in downtown Charleston, which was also the site where hundreds of thousands of enslaved Africans disembarked in the New World. And so the Egungun starts at that point and moves through downtown Charleston along King Street, and stops at the AME Church to, again, to collect those spirits, to honor those spirits, to elevate the spirits of those nine parishioners who were tragically killed. This performance is called an elevation ritual, and it is designed to do exactly that.
So this is, again, linking the living with the dead.
Yes.
You know, the whole idea that spirits are with us mm-hmm. all the time. You've said we live in proximity to death.
Yes.
Right. So there is, of course, the terror of physical harm that you talked about, from the transatlantic crossing to the Jim Crow era, you know, mm-hmm. just like Martin Luther King, you know, gun violence. How did these images communicate hope and renewal?
For me, the idea that beyond the physical, that our spirits are eternal. Our spirits are not only eternal, but they can return. Is a really powerful visual. It's a really powerful awareness, especially in the face of this impending doom and violence that continues to, you know, be imposed upon our bodies. You know, from the very beginning of the histories of enslaved African people being on this continent, that, you know, violence and death has been used as a means to control and coerce you into performing a certain kind of way, to doing what, you know, others have demanded of you. And this, I think, has led to a deep perversion of this idea of death, or this idea of our end. And again, I wanted to create a body of work that would say you can't destroy us. And I think that in that way, there's hope in that, okay, this body ends, but another body will begin. And I really love the way ancestor veneration and ancestors are, the Egungun are considered in the Ifa tradition, in that they're not like over there and you can't reach them. Like they're right there, you know, like you can talk to them anytime. They are allies, you know, in the spiritual world. They're your first line, right? So one of the ways it was described to me was like, you know, when you were a little boy and you were running around playing in the yard and you fell and you, you know, skinned your knee, you would run to grandma and she would kiss your boo-boo and, you know, help you along, give you some encouraging words. Well, our ancestors are, you know, Egungun are the same thing. You know, when we run into a issue or a challenge in our lives, we can go to grandma in the spiritual realm and you know, ask her for her assistance. There's this cyclical, you know, symbiotic relationship. And it's just a really beautiful, beautiful concept. And I think in that there's so much hope. There's so much positivity. You know, you also think about the fact that if your spirit is able to return, then you do no harm, right? You
so
do no harm here.
The concept of karma in other traditions.
Yeah, yeah. You do no harm because you inherit what you are leaving, you know? So why destroy, you know, the planet that you live on? Why, you know, create a negative environment to have to come back to? You want to do good. Iwa Pwele, live with good character. And I just think that that is beyond hopeful. That is an aspiration.
Fahamapuku, thank you. Excuse me, Dr. Fahamapuku. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For
it's been a pleasure.
Us.
Thank you.
Fahamapuku's multimedia show, Do or Die: Affect, Ritual, and Resistance, is at the Michael C. Carlos Museum at Emory University until April 28th. Go see it. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. By the time he was 11 years old, Eric Weiss was famous for unlocking the door of every store in his town over the course of one night. He later became Harry Houdini, perhaps the best-known magician and escape artist ever. He was also a shameless showman and a bit of a smart aleck. Here is the only known recording of his voice, introducing a new escape act in 1914.
Ladies and gentlemen, I take great pleasure in introducing my latest invention, the water torture cell.
The water torture cell. A new exhibit at the Bremen Museum tells both the famous and little-known stories from Houdini's life. Magician David London curated the show. David, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Houdini, what a life. I mean, he was born, Eric Weiss, in Hungary in 1874, the son of a not entirely successful rabbi, I guess. And that's when and where our first Houdini legend unfolds. Tell us about the dueling rabbi.
Sure. Well, actually, I think he was fairly successful in Budapest as a rabbi. He became less successful once he arrived in America. In fact, Houdini's father arrived to America 1 year before the rest of the Weiss family joined him. The Houdini's own story, deemed plausible by experts, is that his father was challenged to a duel in which he accidentally killed the man he was dueling with, who turned out to be a nobleman, and Houdini's father had to flee Budapest, which he seemingly did so with the help of the Rothschild family.
But that does not sound entirely plausible.
It's entirely plausible. Dueling was a common form of resolving conflict in Budapest at the time. His father was well connected to the elite in Hungary, so it was possible that he knew the Rothschilds, and he had to get out of there to get out of Dodge.
Okay, so I take it back. Sorry, Houdini's legacy. The exhibit at the Bremen brings visitors on that same journey as the family emigrates, eventually landing in Wisconsin. And that's where he first saw a magic show, specifically a trick called the Bloodless Vivisection that seemed reminiscent of sawing a woman in half. So we couldn't resist. Here are Penn and Teller doing just that.
Now, after putting Georgie in a cheap plywood box and filling her beautiful legs with splinters, we put a real heavy steel blade in there. And you all said that Georgie, let it show that she really is separated. We'll then put these blades in here. And there you have it, Georgie and Bernasset, a woman sawn into halves right there. That's Georgie right there.
Is that pretty much what he saw?
Possibly something like that. The vivisection he witnessed was supposedly performed by Dr. Lin. He actually would have witnessed that performance when the Weiss family moved to Milwaukee. And Dr. Lin's vivisection was sort of a combination of what we think of today as the sawing in half, but it was also part of the East Indian rope trick, where somebody's would be severed into many different sections, not just in half. And it turns out that even though Houdini believed he had seen the performance of Dr. Lin, the real Dr. Lin was actually performing in Europe at the time. And so Houdini's hero through most of his life was, in fact, an impersonator.
So what was it that got his fancy? Do we have any sense of why he was so enlivened by these kind of magic acts?
I think that most people who experience magic are drawn to the power that it has, and then a select few of us are fortunate enough to have a calling to actually try to present that in the world. And when you start performing magic, something that the audience never realizes is that you get to experience the magic by watching them. And so it gets a little addicting when you perform magic, because suddenly you get to take in the wonder that you're fostering in your audience through them. And so you get to have that wonder sent back to you as well.
Well, who wouldn't want to be magic, especially as a kid? You want to do tricks. You want to disappear when you need to. But, of course, this is all about illusion and misdirection. Is that where Houdini excelled, where others did not?
Sure. Well, I mean, once he got interested in escapes, it wasn't as much about illusion. But I think the main connection between magic and escapes is that Houdini was always interested in new inventions and innovations. And both magic and escapes utilize some really intricate and interesting technology and mechanisms. I think Houdini was really drawn to that early in life.
So a tinkerer and a trickster as
exactly,
a kid.
Yep.
In fact, he saw the circus as a kid, and his first performance was for folks in the neighborhood while growing up. This was called Eric, Prince of Air.
Yeah, he was inspired by a acrobat he had seen at a circus in Appleton. And even though he was calling himself Prince of the Air, he wasn't actually flying through the air. Although he was performing in impressive feat of flexibility, he would bend over forward, folding himself in half, and pick up a needle from the ground between his teeth.
So one of his first tricks was also called the Little Messenger.
Sure. So at the time, Houdini landed back in New York, still Eric Weiss, and he's performing as a telegraph messenger boy, and he creates his very first magic trick. It's a small wooden doll, rather crude looking, and he realizes that it's the messenger's job to travel off far distances. So he works on this illusion where this tiny doll disappears and then reappears at an impossible location, usually in a spectator's pocket.
So do we learn any tricks at the Bremen Museum?
We do teach you one trick. We teach you a card trick called the two-card shuffle. It's an amazing trick where two cards change places, sort of reminiscent of the metamorphosis trick that Houdini would become so famous for. I'm not going to tell you how it's done now. You'll have to go to the Bremen
Museum to
learn that.
Yeah. To see it. So this precocious kid, right? And when he was 12 years old, I guess he pulled a different kind of escape trick, that one that probably terrified his family. He actually ran away. And there's a letter in the exhibit back to his mom.
There is, yeah. I like to call it Houdini's first escape. He's 12 years old, living in Milwaukee, and he leaves his mom a note that says, "I'm going to Galveston, Texas, and I'll be back in about a year. My best regards to all, your truant son, Eric." And there he sets off on his own, never makes it to Galveston, but wanders on his own for about a year and then ends up back in New York City and moves in with his father, who's living at a boarding house at the time.
So this is in New York City. This is like deep in the vaudeville and stage show era. And he had to kind of scrape it together. He worked at a necktie factory, apparently, calling himself Houdini, Harry Houdini, King of Cards. What did that name come from?
So he got the name Houdini because he read an autobiography of one of the most famous French magicians of all time, Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin. And he was inspired by Houdin's life and story. And so he decided that he wanted to lead a life just like Houdin. So he adds an I to the end of the name Houdin to be like Houdin. And that's where we get the name Houdini.
So when did he first appear on stage as Harry Houdini? And what was he doing then?
Early on, he was performing in New York around 1893, both as Eric the Great, as well as Harry Houdini, the King of Cards. And he would present a combination of card tricks and other magic effects. Later, he introduces his metamorphosis effect, where he changes place with a colleague locked inside of a trunk. And this was the first time that Houdini would find himself locked in handcuffs on stage.
So the escape tricks sort of started at that point.
Absolutely.
Now, he was discovered, apparently, Martin Beck, is that his name?
Yep.
Suze, he's a vaudeville theater owner, and saw him perform and suggested that he do these escapes. Imitators popped up around that. How did he keep them from stealing his tricks?
Yeah, so Martin Beck required that he stop billing himself as the King of Cards and move to the King of Handcuffs, but he was always a king, of course. And so in order to stop the impersonators who would bill themselves as also the King of Handcuffs and every kind of eeny you can imagine, wee deeny, tee deeny, trentini, Houdini would go to their acts where they, like Houdini did, would accept challenges from the audience for handcuffs. handcuffs to try to get out of. And so Houdini would make handcuffs that were impossible to get out of. He would go to these imitators' acts. He would present them with handcuffs. And when they couldn't get out, which of course they couldn't, he would jump up and say, "I am Houdini, the only real king of handcuffs." And by 1908, there were so many Houdini impersonators that Houdini took the handcuff escape out of his act. And to prevent anyone else from making money from the act, he published a book revealing all of his methods.
I'm speaking with magician David London, who curated the new Houdini exhibition at the Bremen in Atlanta. It's up until August 11th. All right, so he did come up with one imitation-proof trick, or this was at least the attempt. We heard him introduce this water torture tank. Someone would put his hands and feet into manacles, then he would be lowered headfirst into a water tank with a glass front. The 2006 Christopher Nolan movie The Prestige pays a little bit of an homage to this tank.
If you would tie her wrists, bind her feet around the ankle.
So the woman in the movie, she didn't make it. But Harry Houdini always got out before the, 3 minutes it would take for a regular human being to drown?
Yeah, and actually, sometimes he would never let his audiences witness his escape. He'd always cover the tank with a curtain. And sometimes he would make the audience wait up to 6 minutes before he appeared from behind the curtain. But I believe that he probably got out in less than a minute and was just hanging out, waiting for the tension to build to its ultimate level before he reappeared.
So he didn't necessarily have those drums playing, as we heard in the movie. How did he build the tension?
Probably not. I mean, he would challenge the audience to try to hold their breath for as long as he did. And I know 6 minutes seems like a long time, but the one most difficult escape he ever challenged, he got challenged by the Daily Mirror newspaper to escape from a pair of handcuffs that the best locksmith in London had spent years making. And Houdini did get out of them, but it took him over 3 hours to do so.
Did he ever come close to death in any of his tricks?
So the one time that he nearly died, somebody challenged him to escape out of the belly of a sea monster. Most likely this was a whale that washed up on the shore. They dragged the whale to the theater. He was locked in handcuffs and sewn inside the whale. And that was the one time he nearly died, not because he couldn't escape, but because the toxic fumes from inside the rotting whale nearly suffocated him.
I can imagine. His straitjacket escape often landed him on the front page. In fact, he sometimes would do it right in front of newspaper offices and pulled off the feat just as movie technology was coming onto the scene. So these movies were initially silent, of course. Phantasma Magic posted this version with a little bit of sound. So, David, what's happening during this trick?
So probably what's happening is that at this moment, Houdini is getting locked up in the straitjacket, usually done by police officials. He'll soon be hoisted by his ankles into the air, almost always suspended from the local newspaper building. Sometimes crowds of 50,000 people would gather below to watch him escape. And then over the next 2 minutes, he'll maneuver his body to actually get out of the straitjacket itself.
So he was a master of deception. This is after the First World War, millions of people died, and those who promised to contact the dead started popping up all over the place. Mm-hmm. What was his thinking about?
Yeah, so this was the second rise of spiritualism in America, the first one being shortly after the Civil War, both times being after major wars where many numbers of Americans had lost their loved ones. And so they were desperately looking for ways to be able to hold on or make contact with those they had lost at war. And even though Houdini had studied deception for his entire life, it was the fact that he was so well trained in the techniques of deception that allowed him to see through the methods that these fraudulent spirit mediums were using. So he started holding public lectures in every city he would visit. He incorporated the exposure of these mediums into his act because he saw a big difference between using trickery for entertainment and trickery to take advantage of the weak.
How about his eventual death? This is something that sounds like an urban legend almost. What happened?
It was not. Yeah. So a lot of people believe the story of his death that was portrayed in the Tony Curtis Houdini movie in the 1950s. But that actually paints a completely false picture of what happened. One of the feats of strength Houdini would present throughout his career is he was able to prepare his mind and body to be able to take a punch from even the strongest boxer. And he's performing up in Canada and a college student from McGill University approaches him and asks if he can take any punch. And he says yes while he's backstage reading his mail, and the student starts punching him over and over and over again. He's in a great deal of pain, but doesn't go to the doctor and continues to perform, finishes his run up in Canada, makes it back to America to perform in Detroit. And on the very first night of his run in Detroit, he collapses on stage. And it's discovered that he had been suffering from appendicitis and that punch had actually ruptured his appendix. And so he actually starts to suffer from septic poisoning. That is the cause of the extreme pain, and that eventually leads to his demise.
Houdini, what a legacy he left behind. I mean, this show at the Bremen is just one of many. There are books, there are exhibitions, there's so much fascination with Houdini. But now we have these magicians and tricksters and escape artists. You know, I remember when I was growing up, Doug Henning making the Statue of Liberty disappear. Yeah. Why is Houdini still the one that people say, he's no Houdini or he escapes like Houdini?
Yes, yeah, so I really believe that Houdini was only able to become Houdini at the exact moment that he became Houdini. It was the perfect confluence of timing, new technologies out in the world. The idea of global celebrity was a new concept. Long distance travel became possible. Long distance communication became possible. New technologies and new media made it possible for somebody to really have their image and their story shared around the world. And he embraced all of those things.
What did these kind of shows mean to people at that time?
Yeah, so beyond just entertainment, I think that Houdini's real power was that he sort of became this metaphorical creature. Every time that he would encounter a challenge or attempt an escape, he would sort of live out the inherent human drama that we all go through in our lives. We encounter a challenge, we accept the challenge, we assess it, we tackle it head on, oftentimes or sometimes with great difficulty, and then we overcome. And so each time Houdini was able to escape, he really captured the public's imagination, because they were sort of reaffirmed in their own ability to get out of situations which seemed seemingly impossible to get out of.
If he can get out of the water torture cell, you can get out of your drudgery?
I suppose, yeah.
Okay, we did mention that he spent years trying to debunk spiritualists and mediums, but he did actually believe one may be able to reach the dead. In fact, he thought he might pull it off himself from the grave. How did he set this up?
Well, I mean, Houdini believed that if anyone would be able to escape death, it would be Houdini, of course. So before he died, he set up a secret code with his wife, and she agreed to hold a seance for him on the anniversary of his death each year. She did so for 10 years, was unable to do so. The tradition has continued for 91 years now. And other people try to contact him. Every year, there's an official Houdini seance held on Halloween. The last one was held in Baltimore last year, which I got to attend, as well as the previous one in Cleveland. To this point, 91 years later, though, Houdini has been unable to make contact, but fingers crossed, maybe next year.
So if you were to get a message or have a conversation with Houdini from beyond, what would you want to know from him?
I would like to tell him something, actually. I would love to be able to tell him that he is still famous. And I would love to be able to get into his mind and figure out really what drove him to create Houdini. And I think this is the important part of the story, is that Eric Weiss created this larger-than-life persona that still lingers in the public imagination. And I really just love to understand the inner workings of his mind and try to understand how exactly he made that happen.
Well, we learn a lot more about it at the Bremen. And David, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
David London, he's curator of a new Houdini exhibit at Atlanta's Bremen Museum and is running through August 11th. There's more information at gppnews.org. That is it for today. On Second Thought is produced by Amelia Brock, Leighton Rowell, and the Raven Taylor. Jesse Neiswanger is our engineer. Don Smith, our dean of grammar. Amy Kiley is senior producer. And Sarah Shariari is managing editor for GPB News. We invite your comments, questions, and civil complaints at our Facebook group, GPB Radio On Second Thought. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for listening to On Second Thought.